It's that time of the year again when your nice hosts take a few weeks off from new episodes. We'll be back in 2 weeks, but until then, we've got a couple more of our favorite episodes from the past year to keep you entertained.
While you wait, you can get these and all our episodes ad-free, plus exclusive bonus content that's pretty nice too. Patreon.com/NiceGamesClub.
For this week's Nice Replay, we have episode 296, Metroid is Very Serious, Secrets and Easter Eggs, Player Trust, originally published March 16th, 2023. Metroid is indeed very serious, and I'm always up for playing a Metroid game, seriously. However, in this episode, we also talked about player trust, specifically the trust between a player and a developer. It's a good thing to think about, so let's give this one another listen.
No riffs for this one, you think?
Because
it's a good button.
It is a good button.
It is a good button.
You're on the air with Nice Games Club.
Did you hit the sign?
Yeah, hit that sign up.
You guys, we got a sign.
We got
a sign.
Mark got a sign for the office.
I spent 15 of the show's dollars
on
a little on-air sign to stick outside the clubhouse. For fun and for professional reasons.
Right.
Because how else would you know?
Yeah.
Right.
This is important.
Makes it official.
It really does, though. I don't know. It adds a little bit of, you know, class to our...
It's classy.
I mean, if we recorded in the middle of the day and there were, like, more people coming in and out of the office, like, at the time that we record, but there's usually no one else here in the evenings
right.
We do, so...
Well, Dale knows right now.
Dale knows not to barge in.
Yeah.
But honestly, would that stop her?
No.
No.
In other news, listeners will have heard our conversation with Zach Barth a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
He gave us some codes for the Zachtronics Solitaire Collection as a thank you for bringing him on the show. And I put a lot of time into it.
How much time, Mark?
Well, I could pull up the Steam.
It's actually open right now.
Yeah, it's on the TV.
I'm actually going to check. And this is going to be a very lovely live on air embarrassment.
Keep in mind that we've had it for 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Yeah.
2 weeks. Exactly 2 weeks.
Exactly 2 weeks.
Yeah.
This is a beautiful game.
99.4 hours.
Woo!
I've been playing these solitaire games. That is a huge endorsement. It's a very, very good collection of solitaire games. So we'll put a link in the show notes for that, I guess.
Yeah.
For people to pick up. Because it's definitely taken up. I mean, you know how sometimes you will just find that, I mean, with a lot of video games, you'll find that, like, wow, I can't believe I had that much time.
Mm-hmm.
And you still get your, like, work done or whatever that week.
Yeah.
that's definitely the case with this. I've spent so much of my waking time just playing these solitaire games.
I mean, it's cool. It looks, it's a cool looking game, too. And, yeah, if you're into solitaire games.
It's a really interesting project because it's all the, I mean, we talked about this with him in that episode, but it's a bunch of solitaire games. All of them, except for one, come from all the other Zachtronics games.
Yeah.
And so it's a collection of all the ones they've made over the many years. And as a package together, it's really interesting because you can sort of see, like they have, there's some little notes on each one of them, like how they were created and the sort of context that they appear in the games they come from.
Yeah.
But as a collection, it's really interesting because they were never meant to be a collection. Right.
Yeah. Cool.
In other news, I think we've mentioned this in the show a couple of weeks ago that like we hadn't finished our GDC plans.
Yeah.
I still haven't.
I finally got a hotel.
Nice.
Cool. So
definitely going. Steven, you've decided definitely to not go.
Yes. Due to a variety of different reasons that I don't want to disclose on the show just because they're not good things, but they're not like I'm not in dire need of help. I just, you know, a bunch of things have stacked up to conspired against me from going to GDC this year, I think.
Yeah.
So it's just be difficult for me. But Ellen, you are planning on
I'm on the fence. We'll see.
You're still on the fence?
Yeah, I'm still on the fence this year about things.
It's like 3 weeks away.
Yeah.
I know. Okay. I know. Well, yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Okay, well.
Yeah. Well, I got a really cheap hotel.
Yeah. Cool.
Not that far from Moscone. Nice. I seem to manage it every time. Find a place that's not that pricey and still within walking distance.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually always, I think every year I delay actually doing it. Mm. And it hasn't failed me yet, which is a little bit dangerous. But I didn't buy a plane ticket because I'm going to drive out there. Dale and I just got a new electric car and I thought it'd be fun to do a road trip with it. And it came with like a free year of charging on a particular charging network.
Okay.
So it actually makes it free to drive out there.
Okay.
Which makes it that much more appealing.
Cool.
So the costs associated are just whatever, you know, motel or two or three that I take on the way down there.
Yeah.
So it's, and I've got the time to do it. So okay. If it ends up being just me going, but Dale might come with me, I'm not sure. And Ellen, if you end up coming out, you'll fly.
I'll fly if I end up going.
You can't take all those extra days.
No, I cannot take all the extra days. Yeah. And yeah, it's going to be an insane year for travel for me. So that's why I'm kind of like, I'm still on the fence. Like there's multiple conferences that I want to go to for game-based learning stuff and cousins getting married and yeah.
Actually, the real reason I wanted to talk about it on the show right now, I mean, it's not a great reason. It's just a thing I want to say is that one of the things about driving out there is that then I can go anywhere I want afterward. And so what I'm going to do is after GDC, I'm going to drive down to Los Angeles and I'm going to go to Super Mario Theme Park.
Yay!
Uh-oh, he's changing his mind. Happening in real time, folks.
But, I forgot about that.
They just opened it, and I figure I'm not going to take a week to go to Universal Studios Hollywood. Like, I'm just not the kind of person I am.
Yeah.
But if I can drive out there and spend a day there just to see the Mario stuff,
that's a good
opportunity to do it. Plus, I used to go to Los Angeles every year for the Adobe Max conference, and that has been hasn't been in person for the past couple of years.
Right.
But also, I'm not in that industry anymore.
Right.
So there's less of an incentive for me to go. And that, I mean, GDC is expensive. Adobe Max is expensive.
Oh, yeah.
But every time I go to Los Angeles, I always go to my favorite museum in the whole wide world. I've probably talked about it on the show before, the Los Angeles County Museum of Modern Art, LACMA.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figure if I'm going to go see Super Mario Theme Park, I'm also going to hit LACMA on my way out of town.
Nice.
So I'm kind of, that's going to be my 2-day vacation after GDC.
Yeah.
So cool. That makes it, I mean, honestly, a lot of it's just justifying a road trip in my new electric car. But it feels justified. It won't be that expensive for me. I'm feeling kind of excited about it.
Yeah.
I don't do vacations like as an active thing. Like I don't leap at the chance to do recreational time. Like,
just work all the time.
It's not so much that. It's like, I love places, but I hate travel.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And so it's a stack of excuses to engineer this week and a half for me.
Yeah.
And I think it'll help. It'll be nice.
Yeah.
Have you guys planned, have you checked out charging stations ahead of time?
Yes.
Good.
No, did the whole thing. And so it's actually going to be pretty efficient for time too.
Okay.
I'll leave Friday morning. And if I wasn't going to Los Angeles, I'd be back by Monday night.
Sure.
But yeah, I did this, a website called A Better Route Planner.
Okay.
You might have seen it because you've had an electric car for a while.
Yeah, but we haven't had the range where for the electric car that we have.
Oh, it's a city car, right? It's not really.
Yeah, the one car, my family, my mother has a Chevy Bolt, and that has more of like a road trippable range.
Yeah.
She was actually planning on driving down to New Mexico, and she decided not to do the EV because it just, you know, you get to the coast, you get to the West Coast, and there's stuff all over the place you can charge, but the middle of the country.
Yeah, there's not a lot.
There's not a lot. And there's, you know, you can, sometimes you look on the apps and it'll tell you that there's a charging station there, but if you actually go in and look at the reviews, it'll say, oh, this one's been offline for 3 weeks or something like that. So you have to be really careful if you're driving to the middle of the country. And she likes to go off the beaten path.
Right.
So right.
You have, to be a planner in order to make it work.
Yeah.
The thing about this particular website, you're meant to use it as you drive.
Yeah.
So you can modify as you go, so you can make changes. And things have definitely changed in the past year or two. A lot of these networks have been built out basically to compete with Tesla's network.
Yeah.
So that's been a motivator. It's just not scary to do it anymore, is the consensus.
Yeah.
We'll see when I get back what I think of that. There might be there was a whole bunch of places out. But one of the things that they recommend and the way they plan it for you in these things is you only charge for like 20 minutes or something. And on my car, that'll actually get a lot of the charge. But the idea is fill up a little bit and you stop every hour and a half or so, which is a little bit more than you would in a gas car. But then you never stop. It's always like go as far as you can until you're too tired
and
anymore.
Fall over, yeah.
But if you plan like a 10-minute stop every hour or so, because for an electric car, it just takes a while to charge the thing. Essentially, that makes it just a much more pleasant experience.
Yeah, for sure.
When it's set up that way. And so it ends up being a very different experience. So I'm looking forward to learning about that.
Yeah.
And seeing at what point. Yeah. So you never want to go below like a 25% of charge, because if the thing you're at is out of order, you still need to be able to get to the next one. Anyway, I'm not sure how interesting this is for audience, but like I'm buried in it right now.
Yeah.
Planning my trip.
It's gonna be cool.
Yeah. And well,
you'll get to have a bunch of pictures and shove them in my face, make me feel jealous. So you can like that.
Well, if you want to go havesies on this hotel, you can come to Super Mario Theme Park with me.
Oh my gosh. I'm so upset. it'll be cool. Yeah. I'll go one day.
Yeah.
If there was a Kirby World, then like I would spend literally all of my...
That's called your desk, Steven.
In other Ellen news, you finished a game and started a new one.
I did. I finished a game. I started Hellblade Senua's Sacrifice earlier this year. Yeah. And I finished it. That was pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Powerful
yeah.
experience. I've been sitting on it for a while. I got it like a couple years ago. It's been sitting in my library for a while. I just haven't felt, I felt a little cautious about playing it and starting it, because I've had mental health challenges in the past, and you know, chronic depression, probably will have to deal with that on and off for the rest of my life. And the, you know, the main character doesn't deal with depression per se, but some of the struggles were similar.
Yeah.
You know, there were some recognizable patterns and things like that. And so I didn't want to have to, I wasn't sure whether it would be like a cathartic experience, like a helpful experience, or whether it would just be like, you know, just another trigger.
I'll have to dig this up, but there was, when that game first came out, there was a lot of mental health consultancy that they did.
They did.
And there's a bunch of like documentary content about that process.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it was like, it's a bit of a PR angle, like that a game is taking this, you know, doing something like this more, but in terms of this content, but it is worth taking a look at to see like how, I mean, you played it so you can judge, you know, whether they were successful, but it seems like they really cared about doing it right, and about falling out a lot of the sort of lazy stereotypes about mental health issues that media tends to, even if they don't realize they're doing it, it's so easy to fall into the trap.
Yeah,
yeah.
Those like harmful depictions.
Yeah, I think. I mean, so spoiler, I guess, but like it's right up. It's usually right up there in the descriptions of the game. So the main character Senua, she has psychosis. She suffers from psychosis, which is not something I've ever experienced, and it seems terrifying. Because that's like hallucinatory video, you know, like audio and visual hallucinations sometimes, and sometimes like seeing patterns and interpreting those patterns in the world, interpreting them in ways that make meaning that maybe isn't logical from the perspective of other folks. But like that's what the game kind of explored. Like to really to progress in the game, you had to take the what you saw and heard, and the patterns that the character saw and heard, as that's the reality of the game. I mean, that was her reality, right? So like the question of, you know, did those symbols actually exist? Did this creature that you had to fight actually exist? It's like an irrelevant question.
Mm, yep. Yeah, right. The point is putting you in her shoes that.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the reality that she deals with. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was a really powerful thing, and something that I think would be really difficult to, I mean, it's something that really felt like something only a game could do.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, like, you know, that kind of, well, I think plenty of movies and stuff have fallen into the pitfalls that Mark was talking about before. But I think that you, as the player, experiencing the things that this person is going through makes it establishes that, like, you know, how I guess, like, that perspective, right? That,
yeah.
How it feels. And so like you said, it doesn't matter whether or not it is real or not, because like that is what this person is experiencing.
Yeah.
So like you as a player have to take that seriously in a way that's cool.
The same way that the main character would.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Whereas like in a movie, you know, you see somebody and they're like, and you do the thing. And I mean, I don't know, it's harder to take it as seriously, even if you're, you know, being sympathetic to what they're going through, just because like, it's like if somebody else is describing, their day and why they're sad or something. It's hard to really take that in from an outsider's perspective in the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they did have there's some documentary style content in the game that they recommend you wait till after you're done playing the game to watch. And I did.
Sure.
In the game itself.
Yeah. It's just right there on the menu. and they talked about the process, and they, you know, featured some of the people who consulted on the game, academics, like medical professionals, mental health professionals, and people who like with lived experience with the conditions. Mm-hmm. And they talked a lot about the process and what they tried to do and kind of their philosophy behind what they were trying to do. And I read through some of the criticism, you know, from the game after it was released. And some people were saying that they didn't think that the game did a good job of dealing with the subject matter of psychosis because they didn't give the player the comparison between the like the character Senua's reality and what was actually reality. Mm. But I don't think that was the point.
Right.
Right. It's about empathy necessarily. You're not diagnosing her particular.
Yeah.
Right. You don't have the game isn't asking you to make a comparison between those two things.
No.
And it also doesn't seem to be explicitly telling you that her experiences are real, even though they're putting you in her shoes.
Right. And the whole, yeah, it just, I'm not saying that like that kind of game, a game that did that, wouldn't be a valuable experience and a good experience and an informative experience, like to a player who's going through it and playing it, who's never experienced psychosis before. It just wasn't that game.
One of the things that is particularly when it comes to depictions of hallucinations or psychosis in media is to sort of describe it a little bit like a superpower.
Yeah.
And I think that I remember hearing a little bit of that criticism, mm-hmm. because especially as a game, like you leverage those things to progress.
Right.
I can't speak to the details, but I could see that being a little bit of a fair criticism to like, you just have to be careful with how you present those things.
Yeah.
And I suppose you also have to put some burden on the player to engage with it. You know what I mean? Like you kind of can't help. I don't know. I'm kind of two minds about it. Like,
yeah.
you don't want to provide the opportunity to misunderstand, but you also don't, as an artist, it's not your job to clear up all doubt.
Yeah.
It's tough because it's like, is the job of the game to educate or is the, you know what I mean? The game has a lot of jobs.
Yeah. I think that was some of the criticism that I read too, is that it treated like the psychosis and her, you know, her experiences as a superpower. But I don't actually, I think the only reason that it came across that way is because that's what we're used to feeling from games.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Right, like it wasn't a superpower because the obstacles that, I don't think it was a superpower because the obstacles she was using her power to overcome were of the same nature, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't that she was using her powers to manipulate the world. She was operating within the rules of her world, her reality, which is shaped by her condition.
Right.
Perhaps maybe some of the criticism is you're saying like comparing it to what the reality is maybe it's a subtle explanation to the player that this isn't real, and maybe some people didn't get that or they didn't feel that communicated to them.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know. I can see where they're coming from too. I think it was much more about empathizing with the character's struggles and what she has to deal with day after day, and sometimes the things that she was experiencing weren't terrifying.
Right.
Sometimes they were really beautiful, and sometimes like the voices she was hearing talking to her weren't angry and awful. Sometimes they were helping her. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a complex experience this character was going through.
Yeah,
and rather than just like dissecting it, you just kind of accepted it.
Yeah,
and then just went with it. Went through it with her. I think that was more. I feel like that's what the game was asking the player to do. Mm-hmm. It did not send me spiraling into a deep depression. Yay!
It seems like those critiques were maybe a shallow reading then.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. I think regardless, it's good that people talk about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, it's just I didn't take away that reading from the game.
Right.
When I played it.
I guess it makes a lot of sense that they included all that content. I mean, because they were aware of the sort of charged nature of what they were doing.
Yeah, I'm really glad we got to hear from some of the people with lived experience who consulted on the game. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were there in the featurette that they had, and they talked about both the role that they had in playing, like in designing the game, and also like when they saw the finished product, how it made them feel and whether they were actually going to go play it, which was cool. Yeah, it was really good. That was cool. And just to hear from the team who was working on it and everything like that. Mm-hmm. also just freaking sweet. You know, you go to any like subreddit where people are asking whether like which where are some games where you can play some badass female characters. This one always comes up. Totally, totally true.
Nice.
She's super cool. And then I started on Stray.
Yeah.
Where you're a cat with a backpack in the city.
We talked a little bit about this off mic because I played through that game. Dale hasn't finished it yet, but you were saying that.
What?
What?
I know, right?
Finished it yet?
Yeah, right.
I guess there's enough cat content on the internet to keep her distracted.
Yeah, okay, other that's
cat content in her life.
That's true.
It is a bit of a mystery on the face. But Ellen, you were saying that you expected that you engage with it differently than I have. I've talked about it on the show before, so you kind of know my thoughts.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure like when we first talked about it, you talked about it as like, yeah, you're a cat in the city, and that's about it. And I'm like, you're a cat in the passionate. City.
I guess I didn't have that much of enthusiasm for it. Fair.
Well, like you weren't like, oh, you're just a cat in the city. It
was, that would be my impression.
Right. Just a cat. You're just a cat with a backpack in the city. No, I think you basically said like, yeah, it met your expectations. You're a cat in the city. Yay. Mm-hmm. But for me, I was like, okay, well, I expect this to be just like you're a cat in the city. And then it was, you're a cat in the city. And there's so much junk. You did not mention that, Mark.
There's a lot of junk. Here.
That's true. I feel that was a failure on my part. But well, I suppose it was a delightful surprise for you.
You were giving your honest review of your experience of the game.
Right.
You weren't saying, Alan, you will really like this game because there's so much junk you can knock around, right? And your cat. Mm-hmm. But that is, yes, I have. It is pretty straightforward and not very challenging, but I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Yeah.
So
I definitely did find myself, like, there are opportunities to role play in that game.
Yes.
In a way that, like, even for someone like me who I'm not inclined to, it was pretty satisfying just to just have a little experiences in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Steven, you haven't played it.
Oh, I just watched some people play it.
Yeah, you should give it. I would be very curious to know how you take to it.
Oh, man. I think Charles has the game. I can play it on his PS5.
You can come over and I'm not done with it yet. Come over and play with me.
I'm not excited to play the game. I don't know if I made that clear.
Yeah, but the dogs can crawl on you.
For science. For the show.
You can come over with me and play the cat game while the dogs bother you.
Yay. Oh, okay. We're moving on to a topic. I'll check it out. I don't know. Ellen, you brought a topic to the table. Yes.
Yeah, I did. Okay, so I wanted to talk about secrets and Easter eggs, which I think they're kind of used synonymously, but we can talk about that.
Okay, sure.
Mm-hmm. So I want to just before we do the thing and talk about what we think about secrets and Easter eggs and what our favorite ones are and what are some guidelines for doing it well, mm-hmm. I want to talk about what these are not, right?
Yeah.
So
let's put a box around this.
Yes, we always start with drawing the box.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I mean by secrets and Easter eggs are not the same thing as cheats.
Sure.
Right? Like secrets and Easter eggs are secrets and Easter eggs. They're not things that like deliberately change the way that you play the game. Like right. You're not doing show me the money and getting 10,000, you know, credits or
whatever.
Whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not doing the power overwhelming. I remember so many of the StarCraft cheat codes.
Ah.
Because that's the only way I beat that game.
Okay.
anyway, so they're also not the same thing as glitches or artifacts, right? Like these are put into the game deliberately. So as I was kind of researching this, like I'm not deep into the lore of Mario 64 speedrunning and 100%ing and everything. And I know it's huge because it's been around forever and people are still, So
I will say it's impossible to dip your toe into that without falling in.
I had to quickly back out of the room because there's an impossible coin that someone got like 18. Yeah. Anyway, that is not an Easter egg because I don't think they intended to leave it there.
Right.
No. Right. We're talking about like hard to find objects or secret moves and codes that you have to like guess, but you know that they're there, or at least you know to look for them. Maybe little doodads that are here, like in the dialogue or the name of a character or the name of a building or something like that. That's an homage to a different game or media or something like that. So, you know, they're not required to progress. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we can get to the question of secrets and Easter eggs in a Metroidvania. But like just to illustrate this one idea, an extra power up in Metroid Dread is not, you know, that's not the same as like a critical path suit upgrade. This critical path suit upgrade might require you to like do a weird path around different things. And it might feel the same way as you're getting, you know, pathing to a different like suit upgrade or like a different extra power up, but the suit upgrade is not an Easter egg. You've got to get that suit upgrade to progress in the game.
Yeah.
Not an Easter egg.
Right.
Or a secret. Those things are optional. So that's where I wanted to draw the lines of our sandbox. I'm not sure how many edges it has because I can't count the bullet points.
Yeah,
six edges.
Sure. Okay. Hexes are nice. It's a good gamey shape.
Yeah. True.
So that being said, what are some of your favorite and least favorite game secrets?
Oh, putting us on the spot.
Yes.
I knew that question was coming, so I thought about it for a little while.
I wrote it in the document.
Yeah, okay, good. I'm going to start thinking about it right now.
Okay, cool.
Steven,
cool.
You go first.
Okay, so one that came to mind immediately was in Super Mario Odyssey, when you get, well, really all of this whole world, the whole world when you're in Mushroom Kingdom or whatever, that whole thing. The whole thing is a giant Easter egg.
Yeah.
Just a reference to the, Super Mario 64. And I didn't enjoy it.
I think that's outside of the box, Ellen. Just
is it? No.
Wait, did you say it? Okay, explain more.
Is it so that whole level represent or not represents is reminiscent of Super Mario 64 and like, you know, you get power stars instead of power moons or whatever. Because
right.
Power stars, I guess.
But it's like
narrative.
It's almost like 10% of the game takes place there.
That's true.
There's lots of lots of content there if you want to get all the moons or even I don't know if it's Critical Path, but you do. Everyone comes across it.
No, yeah, it's an end thing. You get it. I think you go to it at the after you beat the game.
Oh, after you get the minimum out of it.
But like, yeah, everybody's gonna go to it probably if you've gotten that far.
Uh-huh.
Specifically, the one power star, I guess you get it. That one is if you like go into the castle and you look up and you stand on the rug and you in the center of it and you look up to the sun, you get a power star from that. That was satisfying because I went in over there and I was like, oh, I wonder if you can get the thing. Because like in Super Mario 64, if you look up in the sun, you get access to the winged cap, and then you can do winged cap stuff. I'm pretty sure that
doesn't that just take you to the magic carpet level.
No, that's on the.
I don't remember.
Got to get back to that reading.
It's been a long time.
Yeah,
get it back.
But yes, it is definitely a specific reference to Mario 64. And I will say that playing through Odyssey, I'd forgotten about that from Mario 64.
Yeah.
Or like it wasn't just. It didn't occur to me to like think about that. You know, I wasn't thinking about, oh, I should do all the things I do in Mario 64 here.
Because
it felt like a normal level that was just a reference to Mario 64.
Got it.
So like I didn't understand. It took me forever to find that one.
Well, so that's the thing, right? Like it's I liked it as a good reference, but I feel like if you've never played Super Mario 64, and there's tons of gamers who haven't played Super Mario 64, even, you know, because they're not old enough, because I'm old now, I guess. Or
hey now. Settle down, Steven.
Or just they didn't have an N64 growing up, whatever, like then they wouldn't understand that reference. And I don't think there's anything that specifically is like look up into the sun to find the star. So like I don't know how people would find it otherwise.
Yeah, because by that point you'd have already beaten the game. Yeah. You'd have enough to beat the game. You don't need that one.
Right.
But it's a pretty natural thing to then want to go for the thousand moons.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
And so
or at least to make an attempt and then
so it does feel like it is actually part of the normal playthrough.
Yeah.
And so it's a little strange.
Yeah.
But I could see the argument the other way. I wouldn't agree with it. But
Yeah. Anyways, that's what I thought of.
Yeah.
Is that.
We'll come back to that idea of like, is 100%ing an Easter egg thing? We'll come back to that.
Oh,
for sure.
Yeah.
Do you have any ones that you didn't like, Steven, that come to mind?
Oh.
There's that one we just talked about.
I didn't like aspects of it. Yeah. I can't think of any off the top of my head.
That's
fine. I think. Ones that like, well, I guess ones. Oh, actually, I don't know if it's an Easter egg or a secret. No, it's not. This isn't the same thing. But I'm going to say it anyway, so you can say it's not the same thing.
Okay.
A lot of times, games will like name quests or like collectibles or something, and they'll give you a little hint, and the hint is like some stupid pun, and I hate that because it's like I'm playing this game. I'm not playing a game that's a pun delivery machine. Please give me, if you're going to make a joke about your world.
Gotcha.
Don't make a joke about, you mean that it's like a reference to some meme or,
yeah, or something.
Kind of fourth wall breaking.
Oh, actually, that specifically gets, there we go. Ooh, I got it.
You got him there, Mark.
I got one. I got it. Yep.
All right. Okay. Go, Steven, go.
I was going to use that one. Go ahead.
I think in a lot of like games, this is a fighting game thing now. A lot of fighting games, like there's a bunch of fighting games now with a bunch made of a bunch of different properties. And I find it frustrating when games pull characters or moves from like that character's like a meme instead of like the actual history from that character. So like the first thing that I think of is like Nickelodeon All-Stars Battle Royale or whatever it's called. I don't remember. It's a long title. I feel like they picked a lot of characters that are just like memeable characters that are like funny because they're like, if you've been on the internet, you've seen them in some video or something that was funny, instead of like a character that people grew up with and enjoyed. And I find that frustrating. And I'm not naming any specifics, I guess, right now, because the only person I can think of is Nigel Thornberry from the Wild Thornberries.
Mm-hmm.
He's not the main character. Like the main character is, I can't remember the name of the main character, but that's because she's not in the game.
I think if I'm in the shoes of those developers,
yes.
And I don't know, even when I was younger, I didn't watch a lot of Nickelodeon.
Sure.
Or rather, I did for a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
So like my era of Nickelodeon is very specific.
Sure.
It's like, it's the Pete and Pete, Ren and Stimpy era, mm-hmm. right? And not after that, nothing.
Yeah, okay.
And so, like, I got off the train before SpongeBob. So,
sure, okay.
I think for a game like that, unlike Mario, mm-hmm. every generation has its Mario.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's a sort of a consistent presence.
And that's fine.
I think a lot of these Nickelodeon properties are kind of come and go and have different audiences.
Yes.
And so my guess is the sort of like SpongeBob memes that everyone is aware of.
Mm-hmm.
I've not seen more than 30 seconds of any SpongeBob material, but I've been exposed to lots of memes that I'm familiar with.
Okay.
If I'm in their shoes, I could see you making that decision to like lean into that stuff.
I get that too.
Because it makes them a little bit more universal. It makes them more familiar, and it doesn't alienate folks who are like, there's only three of these characters I love and they're outnumbered by all the ones I've never heard of.
Yeah.
You know, I can.
No, I understand that. But I think from my perspective, it alienated me because I wanted to see characters that I was, because I watched a lot of Nickelodeon when I was growing up. And I wanted to see characters, well, some of the characters that I watched a lot of shows from, and they didn't show up because like they needed to put Nigel Thornberry in the game instead. So I found that.
Well, I guess there's no winning then.
Well, I mean, you're probably going to win with, I probably wasn't the target audience for that game anyways, to be frank. Yeah. Even though I like Nickelodeon games, I could tell that game was not for me when I watched the gameplay footage. So,
There's some things in there that I want to come back to also, but I want to hear from Mark what his favorite, least favorite.
Oh, I thought I was going to. I spent all this time making fun of Steven for his.
Yep. Your turn.
The one I was thinking of is Mario 3.
Okay.
Going behind the white blocks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because what's interesting about it is that there's kind of no rhyme or reason to it. Like, there's, like, why? Like, there's no, it doesn't reward you with it rewards you with a power up.
Yeah.
It's part of a, you know, a speedrunning path.
Yeah.
But there's no purpose to it. It's not naturally implied by any gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
Famously, if you've seen the movie The Wizard, where the narrative is that the kid is playing Mario 3 for the first time.
Yeah.
And no one's seen it before.
Right.
And he discovers that trick.
Yeah.
That's the one thing all of us were like, no. I had to get told about that on the playground. Nobody figures that out.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what made me think of it for this example, is it's so specific.
Yeah.
And it's completely metatextual.
Yeah.
And even in universe, it doesn't make any, like, not this doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
There's no after the fact justification for it.
Yeah.
But the best thing about it actually is that on the playground, you're like, you know that you can, that first block in level one, you go behind and then blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You can do it on any white block in the game, mm-hmm. which I'm sure there's some people listening who are like, what? But a lot of people know that by now, but I didn't know that for the longest time.
Yeah.
Because there's no other place in the game where that would give you an advantage.
Right.
But you can do that for any white block in the game. And it's like, it's just weird, I think. And I think that's the thing that makes an Easter egg interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I would separate it from a secret.
Yeah. Okay.
A secret I feel like is meant to be discovered.
Ah,
it's,
yes.
It's rewarding you for exploring.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I don't have any particular justification for why I'm building this smaller box inside of your larger.
That's okay. It's a box.
MMA cage. But
yeah.
MMA cage. Right, it's a hexagon.
But an Easter egg feels kind of like metatextual. Yeah. Like it doesn't really.
Yeah.
You know, and that one's interesting because it really divides the line, especially because it is used in speedrunning.
Yes.
And so it does actually have its place in play and in strategy, but I doubt it was intended to. Yeah. I'm waxing on way too long about this.
No, but I totally understand. That's how I would distinguish them too, is a secret is just like a hidden thing that's in the game.
Yeah.
That can be kind of cool or whatever. But like an Easter egg, I think, needs to reference something. Or needs to be meta-textual, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
Like it has to have importance outside of the game in some form.
I think you're mishearing me. I think the thing about that behind the white block is it doesn't reference anything.
Oh, okay, yeah, all right.
It's just it's
to the ground. He's taking him to the ground.
Well, but it is. It's. I think it's interesting because I think the idea of Easter egg is it means reference.
Yeah,
I think that's a common use of it now.
Right.
But a lot of times, especially like in the world of DVD menus, like Easter eggs were really common in DVD menus. There were little secret bits of content that you had to move around in the menus to find.
That's right, yeah.
They were all over the place.
Yeah.
They were extremely common, actually. You have no idea how many you've missed in all your time watching DVDs in the mid-2000s.
Uh-huh.
But very frequently, they would then not have anything to do with anything. Yeah. Like, they would just, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And I think that's probably the last era where the term Easter egg meant just like a fun thing to find.
Yeah, sure.
Rather than something that's sort of intended to be discovered and shared. And I think the internet has a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
The example I don't like is related to this. And I don't mean to like draw a line between these things, like one's good and one's bad. Sure. It's how I think I'm coming off. But the only Metal Gear Solid game I ever played was Metal Gear Solid 4.
Okay.
And that game is just crammed with references
and
gags and things that are like that are fourth wall breaking bits that refer to other Metal Gear games.
Mm-hmm.
And it is in your face all the time.
Yeah.
But I would call those Easter eggs because they do not have anything to do with the game, even though you stumble upon them all the time.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of, there's a difference, like it's not, so that's not, those are not secrets, right? But they are Easter eggs that just, they meant nothing to me.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why I don't like the Metal Gear Solid series. Kind of like, there's a lot I didn't know about that series before I played that one.
Yeah.
And now I'm kind of like, I'm done with that. I don't, for lots of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But that is, I think, made it easier for me to not pick up the next one, I think, because of how it really wants you to play in their field. Like, and if you weren't already there with them, it didn't seem to have room for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that.
Mm-hmm.
They can be isolating in that way. Okay, Ellen, you got to do it now, too.
Yep.
You have yours written down.
So you had all this time plus the prep before.
Exactly.
I'm just saying, a lot on the line here.
Right.
I mean, Steve and I each have one point. One point each, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Right, cage match, I forgot. okay, so I think my favorite, and I think with your taxonomy here, Mark, this would be a secret, not an Easter egg.
Right.
Would be the Lord of the Mountain in Breath of the Wild, which is a spirit creature that is got the body of a horse, so you can ride it. But it is a spirit, and so you can't stable it.
Oh, yeah. I know. It's a ethereal, ghostly type mount. Yeah,
yeah. So you can catch it. You need a lot of. I had a juice link up pretty good because I caught it. I caught all the horses, you guys.
Horse.
Yeah, okay. And this thing isn't a horse, but I did catch it. And I had to juice link hard. I think he came down hard after this to catch this thing.
Goodness,
I know. Yeah, because you just need a lot of stamina to be able to catch it.
Yeah.
And when you ride it, like, it just has it itself has like infinite stamina. You can just run and run and run and run. You try to stable it and the townspeople get mad at you and they turn you away. So you can't actually, keep it.
Yeah. It is really, it's there for its own reasons.
Yeah.
Right. I remember finally getting that. And then it's like the dog that caught the mailman. Like, what now?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I don't know what to do.
You run around, I guess.
Yeah.
And that was, I think that was my favorite one. It was really, it took a lot of work, and it was just in this beautiful part of the game that it took a lot of time for me to discover. And then I had to wait for the right period of time to go get the thing. You know, like it was.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a fun one. My least favorite one. I don't know if this is a secret or Easter egg or even if it counts as either one, but like Super Metroid, when you beat the game with a high percentage and the more of the game, like the higher percentage you get, the more of her outfit that she removes.
Ooh.
Least favorite.
Yeah.
Because that was my first Metroid game that I ever played. I didn't know anything about that. And so like I worked so hard to get a high percentage. I got.
Right. Of course, your first time through, you aced it completely.
No. I spent like 13 hours the first time. I just wanted to get as high as I could. And so I like spent hours and like double checking the map and researching and double checking the map. And it got to like 97%. Still bothers me. It's not at 100. And what did I get? It's like, 97%. Awesome. And then she's like, in a onesie weird bikini thing, and she's like, I'm like, what is this? It doesn't make
you know
any
what that
sense.
Is? That's the game saying to you, you're a boy, right?
Well, like, yeah. I mean,
well, it is a reference to the first Metroid game, and that has a whole thing too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is kind of funny that like, it's a female protagonist in a two piece.
Yeah.
I mean, one step forward, one step back. Is that what that is? Okay. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of, I don't know how you took it as a child or how you feel about it now, but it is very mixed. Like, I mean, Samus being a woman was a gimmick. It wasn't a stride forward.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's hard to, I mean, I think it's different now.
But, oh, yeah.
Oh, for sure. And definitely. In other games, it's different, right? Yeah. Like, you know, you do really well in like Metroid Prime and she'll like take off her visor. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's still kind of, but like that is a character moment.
Yeah.
Right? Like she is. It felt so wrong. And it was really frustrating because I played that game right after I had been able to like nab, because I didn't have consoles in my house when I was growing up. I played with my friends. And, but when I was in high school, I nabbed a vintage SNES from somewhere. And it also came along with Super Mario World and Super Metroid. Mm-hmm. And played the nonsense out of both of those. And I'd never played a Metroid game before and loved it.
Yeah.
And then to have it kind of just like, it was like a little slap in the face at the end of it. It was really annoying because it's just not the character at all.
Yeah.
It's not the character. Yeah. It doesn't make sense at all.
And that wasn't something you were imposing on the character. Like, that wasn't the character.
Yeah.
Like, it was, I mean, the way they were depicting that character at that time, that flew in the face of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had felt so good for getting like to working, you know, getting really good at that game because I like I don't know if I could get it I got to the point where I could get like a really like 80% without even checking anything and like and I cleared it under a couple hours and I don't know that's not great compared to like speedrunning numbers for that game but
I mean
like,
you're not gonna beat speedrunning
no like objectively in terms of like the global practice of Super Metroid speedrunning that's nothing but like for me I don't play lots of games more than once. I played the nonsense out of that game and have that be the ending was just really crappy.
Yeah.
It really leans into the thing that like these kinds of Easter eggs or bonus content or secrets are very often apart from the experience of the game.
Right.
Kind of deliberately and in ways that are often awkward. Right. Mm-hmm. Like isn't there like in Destiny, there's like a cave with a giant sandwich in it or something. Did I see that recently?
So, that's wild.
Just
I have
like
no idea.
For fun, silly reasons, right? Games not taking themselves as seriously, but then that becomes a problem when you, the player, engage them at the level that it expects of you, and then you realize that, oh no, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's when you are developing your game and you're trying to put in. I think a lot of developers want to put in jokes and references and memes and stuff.
Yeah.
But like, if it isn't, I don't know. There's a I think breaking the fourth wall or understanding that that players are not babies, they can understand the difference between a gag and an actual story twist.
Yeah.
But there's still some sort of like respect you have to have for them. I don't know. It's like, who is it for or whatever. Yeah. But then a lot of players don't care. Like the finding a thing is like getting an achievement.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, I guess I'm of two minds of it. Yeah, because I don't like meme-y things, but then I like meme-y things, but not in a game, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or in certain contexts. I guess it's just in certain contexts. That's basically what I'm trying to say. It's like, in some contexts, I'm like, ha, this is funny. I understood your reference.
Right.
But like, in other contexts, I'm like, why did you put this in here? This is weird. This is completely brings me out from the game now. I don't want to deal with this. And I don't know how to distinguish between the two different situations. I don't know. That's a weird. It's a bit. I mean, I guess in a lot of humor is subjective, right? A lot of times when you put in humor things that you think is funny, another it could turn a player off from the game.
Yeah,
right away. And a lot of these Easter eggs aren't necessarily humorous, but they're just like references to things.
And often they're not like deliberately placed by a single developer or the narrative lead.
Yeah,
it's just some gag from some person.
Right.
And
they left it in.
And they left it in. And, you know, not that they snuck it in necessarily, right, although right. that often does happen. Mm-hmm. And so it is like maybe the... Yeah, because I'm of two minds about it too, right? Yeah. It's like, mm-hmm. I kind of want to take everything in your game as seriously as you take it.
Right.
But I need to know how seriously you're taking it.
Yeah. Right.
Like...
Yeah.
Right. Like, I think I would have felt really different about that if it were Bayonetta, you know?
Oh,
like,
yeah. Well, yeah, because Bayonetta's half naked all the time.
That one. And two, Bayonetta just doesn't take itself that seriously.
Right. Yeah, that's yeah. very
Which
true.
Is, you know, yeah. and that I'm fine engaging with a game that doesn't take itself that seriously. That's yeah. cool. It's just that's not what Metroid was.
Yeah. Yeah. Metroid's very serious.
Yeah, it takes itself very seriously. It does, that's yeah. cool.
Right.
So I guess, you know, one of the things I wanted to wrap up this conversation with was just like guidelines. And I guess one of the things that we've been struggling with, and maybe these aren't things that we need to actually like come to a specific point on, like do this, don't do this, mm-hmm. but it's more like consider these things, right? And I guess if your game dynamic is, if your main, like if your core game is finding things, like it would be in a Metroidvania, mm-hmm. I'm not, if you find the hard to find thing, is that a secret? I don't know. Or is it just like extending the game more?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Something to think about. I like what you said, Mark, when you were saying like secret versus Easter egg. The Easter egg is more metatextual and a secret is like part of the game. Obviously, like how hard you want to make the thing to be. Like how hard is it to find the thing? Because some designers want to find a balance. Like they want to hide things that are a little off the beaten path yeah. to kind of create rewards for the players right. who explore. But other player, like other designers are like, no, I want it to be almost like crazy impossible.
Right. They're putting it in there for themselves. They either don't care or they'd rather it be discovered years from now.
Yeah, they want it to be discovered years from now, or they want people to actually like go online, get with other players and figure it out together, which yeah. I think is really cool.
That's very difficult to do in, you know, the age of the internet.
Yes.
You can't really like sneak in a thing because like somebody will just put it on a guide.
That's what makes a lot of these things feel really deliberate.
Yeah.
And part of a mm-hmm. of an engagement strategy.
Yeah.
In a way that is like sometimes can put a bad taste in my mouth.
I agree with that too. But I also think that like a lot of times, I mean, I think in general, gamers don't, myself included, they barely play through a game. Like they'll play like a couple hours and then be done with it, even if it's like a, you know, a 50-hour epic or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I think that games nowadays are a lot more hesitant to just like put in a secret thing that nobody will see unless, you know, unless it's like a super really small thing that mm-hmm. it doesn't matter that
much. Or if it's not going to be seen by a lot of people, yeah. it is very specifically something that doesn't matter that much.
Yes.
Yeah, or yeah. doesn't require a lot of effort to put in. So like with Stray, for example, I go around and look at everything mm-hmm. because I play Metroid games. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes like there are not really secrets, but like, I mean, it's environmental clues to the story and to like the lore of the location and what's happening yeah. that are just yeah. in the environment. And they're there right in plain view if you go look at them.
Right.
But you do have to go take the time to go look at them. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that, but I'm like super explorer kind of person. So
nicegames.club/feedback.
Uh-huh. What happens there?
You can give us feedback.
On what?
Yeah. Why would anyone want to do that?
I mean, because we improve through due to feedback. If there's one thing we've preached on this show, it's that, no, there's a lot of things we preach on this show, but feedback is important. It's very valuable.
If there's one thing, then we haven't been hitting the record button as often as possible.
It's important for us to get feedback so we know what is working about the show and what isn't working about the show so we can make changes to improve or stay the course if things are going swimming.
Yeah, tell us what you love, but also tell us what you don't like.
Yeah.
And it's constructive criticism. We've gotten a not insignificant amount of that, and it's been really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Super helpful.
Absolutely has.
Yeah. You want to hear about other things? Like if you have an idea for an episode type that you want us to try out, or there's a specific topic that you want us to explore, you know, use the feedback form. There are, of course, other ways to get in touch with us, but the feedback form is nice because it is private.
Yes.
And only we will see it. So yep.
You can let us know if you want us to use comments you put on the show or not. You can also tell us what, you know, we have a couple of questions on there that are a little easy, just quick, easy fill out.
Yeah.
And then we have open questions for you to tell us as much or as little as you'd like.
Go to nicegames.club/feedback and give us your feedback.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
So one thing about Ellen's topic that I think I wasn't expecting is we were really talking about that relationship between developers and players and the trust that developers ask to give in them. And I just think if only we had a topic that could just tee us right into that so we can keep that conversation going.
Is that a well-executed Mark transition?
No.
That's about as good high caliber as we get on the show.
It's all we can afford these days.
I'm not even sure where to go from here.
Player trust is my topic. That's where we go.
Okay, thank you.
We talked a little bit about this with the ethics of engagement topic that we had a while ago. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to bring it up specifically relating to player trust. And I think it's like a relationship between, you know, the player and the developer. I like to think of when you start playing a game, the player is like sort of signing a contract with the developer. And vice versa, player, developer, I guess, it's the relationship, right?
Yeah.
Between the game and the game.
Entering into a sacred bond.
Yes.
Signed with blood. The blood from your thumbs.
That's typically where you get the, anyway. and so I think that, like, I wanted to talk about that because, like, I think it's important for us as developers to recognize that players are, you know, approaching your game with a level of trust and to take that with responsibility. And, you know, don't take that for granted because, like, I think if you do that, players will bounce off of your game more quickly and, you know, they'll also downvote it and talk bad about you and stuff. And you don't want all that because, you know, you probably want to stay in business or you want to keep making games and you don't want this person yelling down your throat because gamers do that too.
Yeah, gamers are generally a complainy bunch.
Yes.
But I think you'll see a lot of, like, negative Steam reviews. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I don't want to give any credit to gamers as a class, but I will say you'll sometimes recognize that, oh, they were expecting something different.
Yes.
They thought they were in for another experience.
Right.
And they weren't wrong to have thought that.
Exactly.
And so even though this seems maybe like a bit of an unfair review based on what the game is, mm-hmm. I could see how they feel this way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you don't always have total control as to how the players will react to the things you do.
Yep.
But you can set things up by communicating so you have that trust.
Right.
But you do have to kind of, you do have to establish it.
Right. And to be fair, it is a two-way street, right? Like as a game developer, you know, you're holding this player trust and you're making sure that you're being true to what you're saying about what your game is. But at the same respect, the player needs to come into the game, not, you know, in good faith. Like you don't jump into a fighting game expecting it to be Civilization, right? That would be ridiculous. But like, I don't know, y'all have seen ridiculous Steam reviews.
Well, to use that example specifically, yes. I think like if you going into a fighting game mm-hmm. and then all the controls being really inscrutable,
yes.
you might not like that,
right.
but that's not really something worth complaining about because yeah. you kind of, what I mean, because that is that's an expectation you should have for a game like that.
Yeah.
Even though it might be a legitimate complaint or piece of criticism in the sort of like art criticism sense.
Yeah.
Like you're not asking the developer isn't asking you to trust them to give you an experience that they're not.
The developer isn't necessarily giving you the experience that you want. It's giving you the experience that they have intended for the game. And you as the player, are approaching it. You need to approach it being open to the idea that like the experience might not be exactly what you want, but you're hoping that it'll be something you enjoy. And if it's not, that's okay.
Right.
But that's just not, you know, but it's not necessarily, ideally, it's not necessarily the game's fault. It's just like, you know, it's just to meet your tastes. Mm-hmm. And that's a different conversation, right? We're specifically talking about like players and making sure that the players can feel capable of experiencing the experience that you want from the game. Mm-hmm. So it's important to like establish that trust. And a lot of ways you can do that, you know, is to make sure that like the controls feel responsive. When the player pushes a button, something happens. And it's not just like, you know, well, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't happen. Like make sure that like it isn't necessarily that your game feels tight, because sometimes games don't feel tight and that's like the point. But I think it's important to just make sure that like players can feel like they can take actions. Things can happen in the game due to the player's control. And if they don't happen, that the player knows when it's their fault, when it's not their fault.
Mm, it's got to be consistent.
It's got to be consistent.
Yeah, it's a predictability.
Yes.
And however it is that your game behaves,
right.
the player should be able to predict some parts of it. Right.
Right.
And know what is and isn't predictable.
Exactly. Yeah, because if you can't predict what's going to happen, then it's just like pure random. And then it's like, why am I even here playing this game in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's hard for the player to even get it, you know, immersed in the experience when they don't feel like they can understand it.
I think a good sort of, I think a lot of people have played or made mm-hmm. indie platformers
yes.
that the controls are a little slippy mm-hmm. and yet it's kind of a precision platformer.
Yeah.
And you could, a developer might expect the player to, by level 3, have the skills to blah, blah, blah,
yeah.
right? But the player, like, they don't have the trust of the player, and so the player doesn't bother learning how to do any of that stuff.
Right.
Because they don't see their efforts being rewarded.
Yeah.
And so by the time they get to level 3, they don't have those skills, yeah. and the developer is very confused.
Right. I mean, in the same vein, maybe your controls are tight and snappy, and they feel good, and the player understands it pretty well, and, yeah, I don't know, you do a good job introducing the controls and stuff. But the level and the levels that you've designed mess with the player and mess with the player's expectation in the way that makes it so that they can't trust if they land on this platform that platform is an actual platform. I mean, there are games that like play around with that, and that can be interesting or frustrating, or at least make good stream content, I guess. But I think that like you as a developer need to make sure that the player can feel capable in a world like that. Like they need to make sure, you need to be able to make sure that players, when they land on a platform, know that the platform is static and you can land on it and it's safe. Or know that this platform is going to collapse on you if you stand on it for 2 seconds. Or know it's going to move a certain way, certain which way or whatever. Like those things, I think having that kind of consistency can help players feel comfortable in your world.
Yeah.
And can help them feel more immersed and, you know, maybe reach, you know, that flow state or whatever. Or just at the very least feel like they can engage in the game and make sure it's not, and make it so it doesn't feel like the game is like making fun of them for not understanding a thing that they didn't introduce to you in the first place.
Or at least if it does, it teaches them that that's how things are going to be introduced,
yes.
right? So like I have a more relaxed playing experience when a game introduces a new mechanic by letting me just jump into it, but also then like immediately giving me like a safety out when I realize I'm in trouble. Okay, you jumped on the platform and the platform is dissolving. Okay, I can see that that's happening. Good for me that the first time that game did this, it had another like quick escape platform for me to quick jump to.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to fall into the pit of spikes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, the second or third time you get to it, there's a pit of spikes there. But at that time, you've established how this thing works.
Right.
And you can, you know, you can trust that you as the developer can trust that the player will hopefully understand that. And the player will understand and trust that this is how this platform works now. And
So that
gives you, the developer, that gives you leeway to, like, you know, make more difficult, more complicated levels or mechanics based around that one thing.
Yeah, and that can be a surprising moment where the player is not expecting something to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But then what that tells the player is that this is an authored experience.
Yeah.
And so now the player understands that if I'm going to be surprised, it's going to be deliberate on the part of the developer. Mm-hmm. I can charge forward understanding that maybe this platform will fall under my feet and I will have no way of knowing it, but I will at least know that it's a deliberate experience that the author is providing for me and not just some random stuff that I'm just meant to know.
Yeah, it's a possible, you know, like I'm going to get surprised and it's possible I'm going to get surprised. So like, I think the Dark Souls games are full of these too because like it takes a different approach to things, right? Because like you learn the game through dying over and over.
Yeah. Right, like a lot of precision platformers have quick respawns for that same reason is that they and this is just all about predictability, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just a different kind of predictability. Right. It's like, I will predict to have no idea what to do.
Right.
And I'm expect to try some stuff out.
Yeah. Yep.
And I know I will be not punished for doing so. And I'll get a couple of chances before. And I won't leave, you know, step one, you know, off the starting line without dying four times. But I will expect that that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And Dark Souls games are like that. Like, you expect. It's not quite quick respawns, but
like it's upfront and consistent about like you will have to die a lot in this game.
Right. And if you don't like that, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But like that's what the game then the game is just not for you.
Right. Don't play it or as part of your experience as a player, learn to accept the dying part.
Yeah, sometimes it's nice to be a tourist in a genre you're unfamiliar with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you just have to kind of like, I don't like this, but like, I'm going to play on its level for a while.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And then like, sometimes they mess with you. Like, there's a ball, like a big stone ball that like all the balls up to that point roll past you.
Yeah.
And then there's one that like rolls past you and stops and then just comes at you.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's something I want to talk about too. Like, if you've established that trust, you can play around with that a little bit as long as you don't play around with it too much.
Yeah.
You don't want to like completely just shatter any hopes and dreams that the player had.
Right.
But like, but it's perfectly fine to like toy with the player a little bit, like mimics, for instance.
Yeah.
Like in games, you know, you open up treasure chests, the first 10, the first 15, the first 30, perfectly safe. There's the 31st one. You open that one and teeth pop out and it starts chewing on you.
Well, and that's the contract you're signing with the player then.
Yeah.
It's like the you know, things aren't going to always be what you expect.
Yes.
And that's the experience you should expect.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Stay on your toes.
So it's very complicated, like in terms of walking that balance. And I mean, we're just talking in the last segment about the looking up into the spotlight in Mario Odyssey as a reference to Mario 64. That felt like it was, I didn't like that because it didn't feel like I would have any reason to expect that.
Yeah.
And if I'd have thought to do that, I might not have even tried it because I wasn't expecting that to be the answer.
Yeah.
Right?
I agree. Like,
so it is easy to fumble these things.
Yeah.
And not the end of the world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you still went through and got all of them.
I mean, Odyssey's a masterpiece.
Okay, masterpiece. It was all right. Yeah. But there's some leeway. And like I said, I think it's important for players, and this is kind of hard for us as game developers, giving advice on high to players. But like, I think it's important for players to come into a game, you know, with good faith, and expect that, you know, things are not going to go exactly the way you expect them to.
Yeah.
And that's okay, because like, you know, we as developers are taking you on a ride, and you're trusting us with, you know, your time and your effort. So you should be able to, you know, you should be able to trust us, or we should be able to give you that, you know, that ability.
Yeah.
Yeah. The player's already extending trust by buying your game
Yes.
and playing it and spending some time on it.
Right.
So we've got to earn that trust or indicate that it's justified throughout the experience.
Right. And the more you make good on those expectations, the more that you deliver what players, I mean, not literally what they expect,
yeah. but
the experience that you've promised essentially through the up to then experience, right? The terms on this is really kind of easy to mix up.
Yeah.
But the more you do that, then the more trust you have that you can then play with, as you were describing earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, and players will enjoy that. Like that whole, like the ball, all the balls are normal except for this one ball and it smacks you in the face. Like you wouldn't expect that as a player. And it's like a bit of a comedic, you know, twist.
Yeah.
And even if you die from that, and you might die from that, and it might be frustrating, but you'll be like, what the heck just happened?
Yeah.
You know? And as a game where you die a lot,
yeah.
like killing you unfairly is not an unfair experience.
Right. Because it's something that has been established at that point.
It's within the contract.
It's within the contract.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of like writing it or explaining it in a terms of a contract because like I think your relationships you have with people in general, you kind of have like contracts understood between you, even if it's not like a literal written down thing, you know, and sometimes the boundaries of that contract need to be better established because like it's not as clear. Somebody might have a different understanding of how things work versus another person.
Yeah.
But like that's part of the, you know, the push and pull. That's part of the conversation that's happening between the two players, and it's the same way between a player and a developer. You having a push and pull conversation between you two, but the game is just the medium in which you're communicating. And it's important that, you know, you're both establishing your boundaries, and it's kind of difficult as a player. Well, I guess as a player, your boundaries are this game is too hard for me, or it's way too long or something, and I can't handle this. I appreciate what the game's doing, but I can't do this or whatever. It's just too much or it's too long or whatever. And so you just, you know, you bounce off of it, and that's fine.
Well, more narrow than that.
Yeah.
Like thinking about, say, you want to put an Easter egg somewhere in the game, right?
Oh, yes, yes.
You want to put it behind your game is a platformer, just say. And it's a Metroidvania, say, so it's not really demanding a ton of platforming skills specifically.
Yeah.
But then there's a secret that requires like white knuckle Super Meat Boy platforming.
Yeah.
And it's just a secret.
Yeah.
But it's not the type of gameplay the player expects. Yeah. So that might be something that like, well, then they're not going to put in the effort to engage with that part of the game.
Yeah.
Because it's outside the contract.
Right. Yeah. That's absolutely
correct. Now you can have a game that has, you know, more casual explore-y platforming and then certain hardcore platforming. Like there's no reason you couldn't, but building that is harder than just putting both those things in your game.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. 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 And I guess like in the same vein, the player's communicating or the developer's communicating to the player through the mechanics and such. And so it's important that, you know, you keep that the way that you're establishing those boundaries as a developer is you tell the player what they can and can't do, and what things make sense for this world, what things make sense for this game, and establish that, you know, when it is relevant to establish that information. Because otherwise it'll be difficult for a player who's coming into a game with a certain expectation to get a different experience, but also it'll be difficult for a player who's coming in with an expectation for an experience and is trying to get that experience but isn't able to get that experience due to like the way that the game works. I found that to be kind of helpful, I think, when I'm thinking about like things in terms of like in terms of design and things like that, as I think about what kind of an experience I want for the player, and how when the player reaches this part of the game or this game, or, you know, decides to play my game or whatever, I'll think about how I want the player to experience that, and how I want to make sure that the player can experience that and is able to experience that without things impeding the player. And there's a lot of ways that, you know, things can impede the player. And it's not necessarily just there's a bunch of bugs and glitches in the game breaks or something like that. It can also just be, you know, this quick time event is rough, I guess, like maybe having to mash the button. I think as a community, game devs have been pushing away from like mashing buttons to solve problems or whatever, which has been good, I think. But like, you know, maybe you opt to not have that in so that like more players can play it and players can trust that like they don't have to have mashing ability in order to get through the game, things like that. Or give players options so that like you can have mashing in there, but maybe there's an option to just hold the button down or just like tap the button once and it'll do the thing or something like that.
Right. I think some actionable information sort of based on the on what you're describing.
Yeah.
I think when you're playtesting your game,
mm-hmm.
I think one thing you can do is you can ask players what they expect to happen next.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Particularly once, like if you're playtesting a level and just one level and they're done, mm-hmm. I think a good sort of, you can do this while they're playing because it's good to see what they expect and what they see.
Yeah.
Without maybe influencing them too much. But one thing you can ask them when they're done is, okay, you've just played half an hour of this or 5 minutes of it or whatever. What is this game to you? What do you think will happen in level two? Like, describe what, not what you'd want to happen, mm-hmm. but what you what's been shown to you. What would you expect to happen next?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can say, I mean, because it isn't, if they don't describe what is next,
yeah,
that's not the end of the world, right? It could be just that, oh, okay, I need to explain this better. Or, you know what, I need to change something in this part so they can, or it could be like, okay, so this is going to throw them for a loop. How do I prepare them for that?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so there's no wrong way to proceed.
Yeah.
But just knowing where the what the player is thinking and what they're expecting can help you decide how to make decisions and engage with that player. Because when you're working on the thing, you're not in an active conversation with the player.
Right.
And that's what playtesting is really good with. But I think that would be a little another arrow for your quiver is to ask that question.
Yeah. That's what's so fascinating about games in general. It's like it is a conversation between two parties,
mm-hmm.
but like the conversation is happening like intermittently, I guess. Like it's almost like through mail or something. I don't know. It's just really fascinating. Yeah. I just enjoy that aspect of game dev so much.
I like game dev too.
Yes.
It's a good note to end on.
Yeah.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Twitter and Mastodon at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets and toots about game dev resources and aggro crabs the sock. All right. We like hearing from you, so tweet and toot back or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff. Lots of content, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.